Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Retronauts. The topic for this one is the return of our listener comments catch-up episodes, and I am your host for this one, Bob Mackey. And who is here with me today?
It's your favorite old man, Jeremy Parrish.
Favorite old man, indeed. And today, because I try to, every 6 months, I try to build a listener comments episode because I never have time to read comments during the episodes. And Jeremy, you do mailbags too, right? Just because there's never enough time to actually do the mailbag within the context of the episode itself.
It's really tough to squeeze those in because we're just so gabby.
We are. We talk too damn much. That's why we're podcasters. But Jeremy's here because we're recording in San Francisco. And also Jeremy's here because there were a few podcasts I wanted him on, but we were both traveling a lot this summer. And he was not able to make it to a few of them. And my schedule was very complicated, too. So he's finally here to talk about some topics. And also he's going to respond to some of your comments with me.
I promise to be nice, though.
Yes. From my episodes from the past 6 months, and the first of which we're going to start with episode 204, way, way back in the winter time. And that was Spider-Man Games Part 2. And Jeremy, you just released another Spider-Man podcast, right?
Yeah, someone recently. That was me. That was a few weeks ago, and that was an interview with Jamie Fristrom, the designer and technical lead on Spider-Man 2 for PlayStation 2, prefaced a little bit by some kind of like preamble with the Retronauts East crew. But that was one of the episodes I put together with developers at Game Developers Conference this year. And it's always great to talk to devs and get their perspectives on the games that they created. Although having not really played a lot of Spider-Man games and not really spent a whole lot of time with Spider-Man 2, it was much more of a general conversation, just kind of like almost like shooting the breeze with someone who made a cool video game. I don't know if that's what people actually want from developer interviews, but sometimes it's nice just to loosen up a little bit and take a different angle.
I think it's a good companion piece to this episode because we talk a lot about that game in this one. It's sort of one of the major focuses of that podcast because it's one of the best games ever made about Spider-Man up until the new one that came out last fall. But
which is now the best-selling superhero video game of all time.
Really? I believe it. So more than Batman then.
Yep, more than the Arkham games.
Yeah. Interesting. I guess the Arkham games came out after. I guess they came out during the Nolan stuff. Never mind. But that's cool. I'm glad to hear that. I hear it's a really good game. I still need to play it. I will one day. But let's talk about comments for Spider-Man Games Part 2. I pulled a few from each episode just so we could fit them all in within an hour. And so Team Zisu says, one thing I've always loved about Spider-Man games from this era is the level of care and fan service that appears even in some of the mediocre entries. The first PlayStation Spider-Man really blew the lid off the concept with its bonus costumes and cameos. I know that you guys had to rush through some of them towards the end, but Shattered Dimensions really stood out from the pack, even though it was the first console Spidey game to take a step back from the open world concept. Beenox even went as far as to cast each of the four different Spider-Men with someone who had previously voiced a character on the show, including Dan Gilvezan from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and even Neil Patrick Harris from the short-lived MTV CGI series.
I did not realize there was a Neil Patrick Harris voiced Spider-Man CGI series.
That might be the it is the MTV one. So like when the Tobey Maguire movies were coming out, there was an MTV series that was CGI. And I didn't know that was him because I never watched it. But there you go. So the story was created by Dan Slott, which a lot of comic book fans should know. So who took the inspiration from Beenox's groundwork and later created his own Spider-Verse storyline that just got adapted into an Academy Award winning movie. Talk about a legacy. Speaking of writers, these games have also incorporated creators who have worked on Spider-Man comics in the past. That list includes Brian Michael Bendis, Dan Slott, Peter David, and even Christos Gage on the latest PS4 game. And that was from Team Zizzo. And I will say that before that podcast, I believe I don't even know if Spider-Verse was announced, but maybe it was just announced and we were speculating as if it would be a good movie. Well, since then, it's won the Oscar for Best Animated Feature of that year.
So that was episode 204. That would have been about like 8 or 9 months ago.
We recorded it in October, though. So I don't know. I recall that we knew about Spider-Verse, but it wasn't out yet.
It was known, but I don't think anyone knew it was going to be what it was.
Yeah, and I'm a known. I don't really care about superheroes that much, but I love that movie. Have you seen the movie Spider-Verse?
Yeah,
okay,
it's really
great.
Good.
I personally feel like superheroes are too stupid looking to work in anything but animation. That's why I like that movie so much. It's the perfect cartoon movie, and it also up front it's like you know what Spider-Man is. You don't need for us to give you a 45-minute prologue as to you know the whole Peter Parker, Uncle Ben dying stuff.
Yeah, it was that was an interesting movie to me because you know, they took the multiverse concept and actually made something that was basically a sequel to Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man game movies without it being explicitly that. It was pretty much like, you know, the main Peter Parker in there, the one who, spoiler, dies, he's basically Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, and that's true.
So it's like kind of a, puts a cap on, you know, that older set, the older trilogy of Spider-Man movies, while also feeling like it could fit into the current modern Marvel universe. So it was a nice touch.
I was happy with that. I went to it very skeptical, but I really liked it. And we did a podcast about it for What a Cartoon, if you want to check that out. But Jeremy, we got another comment here for Spider-Man Part 2.
Yep. Muteki says, I looked it up and apparently Spider-Man 2 got a PC game and it's completely different from the Treyarch game and is bad and sucks. Looks more like the PSP games in terms of how you interact with it. And given that the PC, PSP, GBA, and DS games with the same name are all apparently distinct, methinks part of the issue is that Activision spread their resources way too thin. Genuinely surprised to find out that a PC port existed and wasn't like the same game as showing up on all the consoles. But then I think they targeted the PS2, and most middleware of the era didn't.
Yes, thanks for the info on that. I think I'm glad you forgave us because these games are just so unavailable that sometimes you just have to assume a port is a same thing as, you know, another game. But in this case, it is different, and it sounds like it's not worth playing or buying used or whatever. So screw that game, I will say. So the next episode is Goodbye, Reggie Fils-Aimé, which Jeremy was on. That was our Retronauts about the departure, Reggie Fils-Aimé, who is gone now. Still alive, now on Twitter, at Reggie. How did he score that? I don't know. I think he knows somebody there. But now we're in the reign of Doug Bowser, and I think he's taking advantage of that joke a little too much. We thought, does he know that he's the same name? And now that's all you see on his Twitter account. So it's getting kind of boring now.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, it's the perfect choice. So our first comment for that is Gut Sant saying, I'll always remember the personality that Reggie brought to Nintendo presentations, particularly the several Nintendo Direct moments where he participated, like the famous Reginator, when he fought with Iwata in Smash, or when he fired Bill Trenton to replace him with his son. He did give NOA a distinctive personality. It goes to show that Nintendo really knows how to select people, particularly when comparing Nintendo executives to the ones from other gaming companies, like you exemplified with former Xbox executive Don Matrick. Reggie showed that there are some executives that one can respect, even when they are not from the gaming business originally, like Iwata, and quickly quelled fears of a John Scully for Nintendo.
Wow, deep cut, I approve.
Which one is John Scully?
John Scully was Apple's CEO.
Oh.
He basically was the replacement for Steve Jobs when Steve Jobs got ousted in the 80s. And he was a Pepsi executive who came in and tried to run Apple Computer like it was a soft drink company. And
those were dark times for Apple.
Yeah, Apple did not do well under John Scully. Although Scully did... you know, he had some good ideas, or at least kind of like spearheaded them, like the idea of a digital personal assistant, which is basically what we have now with cell phones and Siri and that sort of thing. Anyway, that's okay. In the weeds, but
I'm glad you explained that.
That's the explanation.
I wasn't sure what that meant, but I'm glad you explained that. So he goes on to say, we can safely assert that Reggie is more appreciated by fans than former NOA executives like Howard Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln was a successful executive for the company, but most gamers probably remember the Senate hearings where he buried Sega hard.
He was a cop.
He's totally a cop, and he's not Howard Phillips, by the way. Different people. We have to keep pointing that out. But in a sense, the letter says, Reggie was the kind of admirable leader that Iwata was in Japan with how he stayed with the company during the difficult times and goes away on a high note on his own terms. He also wants to know, by the way, why is the Art of the Podcast a Zardoz-inspired piece?
What the hell was that?
I just told my artist, the person who does the art for my my covers is my friend Nick Daniel. And I just said, I don't have an idea for this. Do whatever you want with it. And Reggie has a famously giant head. So I think he thought, what else has a giant head? Oh, Zardoz. And people really liked that cover. It was kind of inexplicable, though. But the giant head connection makes sense to me.
Okay. Yeah. I just kind of looked at that and was like, huh, all right. I mean, I got that it was Zardoz.
Yes. The important thing is it got people's attention.
Right.
It's good publicity.
And the important thing is that it wasn't like Nestor or someone wearing the Sean Connery mankini.
Yes, I'm glad he kept that out of there. It was tasteful, I'll say that. But yes, I totally agree with you, Gut Sant. I do miss Reggie, but he's still out there on Twitter if you want to say hi to him. Jeremy, do you want to take this first one about Kingdom Hearts 3, episode 210?
Oh, yeah. Jonathan says, one thing you didn't touch on was people's reaction to Lance. Is it bass or bass? Lance Bass.
Bass, we must not fight.
Okay. Voicing Sephiroth and everyone going crazy at how someone from NSYNC could voice a guy like Sephiroth. This might have been one of my earliest memories of internet controversy, though to be fair, my family didn't get an internet connection until the very late 1990s, so I missed a lot of the early examples. And it was built around nothing since he did an amazing job at it, but because people are dumb at times, we can't have nice things. Anyway, I feel like that's the the preamble, the early version of Robert Pattinson as Batman.
Oh, yeah, it's true, yeah. And I mean,
he's got a great chin, so it's going to work.
It's a great chin, yeah. It's all you need, a lot of chin acting. But I think like then we were in the boy band backlash after that craze had subsided, and I think—
And now, thanks to Korean boy bands, everyone loves boy bands.
Yes, yes, they're even prettier, I will say that. But yeah, I think you're right about that, Robert Pattinson as Batman. I think we are finally escaping the Twilight backlash. And those movies aren't his fault. In fact, both people that starred in that movie, those movies kind of hate them.
I don't know, and they're actually good actors.
Yeah, they are good. They were just forced to be in terrible crap.
Yep. And so, they made a lot of money for it, so God bless them.
And I will agree that he was good as Sephiroth, and he's been to space too. So that's what Lance Bass does now. He's in space. I'm not kidding. So Smug Porky says, I have an interesting relationship with Kingdom Hearts as someone who only recently played through the entire series on PS4, like within the past couple of years. I am completely into this weird universe where Disney properties exist as their own planets, and Mickey Mouse has to deal with anime drama on a regular basis. As the games went along, it could have used more Disney and less original characters. I'm 100% here for the Disney content first and foremost, but even the anime boys won me over by the end. While I generally don't have a problem with the overly complicated yet heartfelt plot, the gameplay is what polarizes me most. 3-2 and most of Dream Drop Distance are the only games I can say I legitimately enjoyed playing. 3 is by far my favorite one in the series as far as the gameplay is concerned. It's the first game in the series that felt to me like it knew exactly what it wanted to be, and I had fun playing it from start to finish. All of the other games, including parts of 2 and Dream Drop Distance, came across like they were trying to test some new game mechanic that either wasn't fully thought out, could easily be ignored as part of the main gameplay loop, or was just plain old not fun, looking at you, chain of memories, and as a result were a chore to play through. 3 takes the best bits from those respective systems and mechanics, simplifies them, and combines them into a combat system that I actually have fun with and want to use to its fullest extent. It's a shame it took this long to truly refine Kingdom Hearts gameplay, but now I can say I am truly looking forward to whatever the next entry in the series may be. I mean, I totally agree with you. Kingdom Hearts 3 is not the kind of game I particularly care for that much, but I played it just to close the book, just because it finally existed.
Wow, there's going to be another Kingdom Hearts?
There has to be. I mean, well, once the Final Fantasy remake is done, and once every Disney voice actor is recast.
So 20 or 30 years
from
now.
Yes, so... Haley Joel Osment needs to survive until then. That's all I'm saying. Jeremy, so we did a whole episode about Sonic the Hedgehog's many voices over the years. So this is what this whole thing was about, who played him in both Japan and America throughout the history of the character. So can you take this first comment?
Sure. Nathan Daniels says, hey, guys, nice episode. You guys commented on Ryan Drummond's Sonic performance as being really high-pitched. I'm guessing it was to mimic Junichi Kanemaru's Sonic voice. The first thought I had was how similar they sounded. I'm also surprised that Kanemaru's first gig as Sonic was with Sonic Adventure. I can't find the proof, but I swear that back when Sonic Adventure was still forthcoming, I read in GameFan or somewhere that Kanemaru was described as the guy who did all the Sonic voices in Japan. It's interesting to hear your takes on the earlier Sonic cartoons. I stubbornly adhere to my own private headcanon that Sonic never existed outside the games. Sonic was a lot less of an ass in the early games, especially without the obnoxious American Sega ads and mediocre deuterocanonical media.
Hmm. That's a GRE word he just used there.
That is.
It's worth memorizing. So apparently I missed a Sonic voice. I'll play that live on the show. He did talk in the Sega CD version. I'm not sure who plays him.
Yes! Yeah! All right! I'm out of here!
So that's all Sonic said in the...
Yes.
All Sonic said in the Sonic CD version of the game. So there you have it. Just for the sake of thoroughness, that is all the Sonic voices to date recorded on Retronauts.
That could be anyone's voice.
It could be anybody, but according to YouTube, it's Sonic. So I trust YouTube. So up next is Stardew Valley. We recorded that here. So that's episode 216. And John Simon says, thanks for mentioning the crazy protracted development time and what it's like for a single indie developer to devote themselves body and soul for years and years working in isolation and not knowing if it'll actually do anything on the market and disappear in a puff of smoke. Once in a lifetime is a cliche phrase, but someone really does things like this maybe once in a lifetime. I write software for a day job and dabble with Unity and Quake mods on the side, but there's no way in hell that I've ever have done the do-or-die wherewithal to build the entire game like Stardew Valley or Axiom Verge. Jeremy, you weren't here for that, but basically the Stardew Valley guy worked for years, like an inhuman schedule, to make the game. And as much as I respect and would like for my own life to have a good work-life balance, having a bad work-life balance made Stardew Valley happen, so I'm conflicted.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you also have, he mentioned Axiom Verge, Iconoclasts.
I don't know the stories behind those, but I assume they're very similar.
Yeah, and maybe not so much with Axiom Verge, but definitely Iconoclasts. Like, people really break themselves to create these games. And, you know, Stardew Valley was a huge hit. I don't think Iconoclasts was nearly as big. And it's a shame because it's a really well-made little game. But, you know, it's just, I don't know, throwing so much of your life into a project like this and hoping for the best is tough.
Yeah. But I'm glad it turned out well, and I'm glad the episode turned out well too. So we have one more on Harvest Moon and Stardew Valley, Jeremy. So that's from Mike GG.
He says, I missed out on Harvest Moon during the Super NES days, but would later become a big fan of Harvest Moon 64. I was disappointed by Harvest Moon titles that arrived in subsequent console generations. I know I should check out Story of Seasons, patiently awaiting the next title on Switch, assuming that day ever comes. Then Stardew Valley came seemingly out of nowhere and filled that niche. It doesn't necessarily do anything new, but it streamlines just about every aspect of farming sims and packages them into a cozy retro aesthetic. Maybe it's just me, but the graphical style reminds me of Secret of Mana, as does its fantastic soundtrack. I poured more hours into the PC version of the game than I would care to admit. Definitely my game of the year 2016. I recently picked it up on Switch and am hooked all over again. I still can't get over the fact that it was made by one guy. Hey, speaking of Harvest Moon 64, does anyone else have a soft spot for that plasticky, isometric graphical style? No? Just me?
I think there is there's some nostalgia for that. I would be surprised if some indie developer makes a game with, like, purposely poorly rendered CG sprites
in the
future.
Here comes the Camelot sprites.
Yeah. It'd be kind of fun to see those again, but I don't know how my eyes would feel about that.
I disagree.
I mean, I can still play Mario RPG because I like that game a lot, but it is hard to look at. And I will say, like, it's funny. So Stardew Valley came out. It's been out for like 4 years now, but Story of Seasons and Harvest Moon still persist, and I still don't play them because Stardew Valley exists. But what's funny is Story of Seasons is so desperate for your attention that they have the Doraemon license now, and they're bringing that to America.
Which is weird because no one in America knows what Doraemon is.
And you're not even playing as Doraemon. You're playing as the little kid,
Nobita?
His friend. Yes. So... it's weird.
What's even the point?
I don't know. I call him Blue Garfield.
Can you marry a Doraemon at some point?
Maybe other characters from Doraemon are in the game, but America doesn't know Doraemon at all.
Yeah, it's...
But it's a weird choice of bringing it here. I think it's just a stab at like some sort of relevancy. But yeah, it's they have not really upped their game in the way I thought they would.
I want Ultraman Story of Seasons.
Ooh, yes. I don't know what he would just like tear down cities to like build crops or whatever.
Yeah, he would harvest by using the crossbeam.
The weirder the license, the better if you want to make these other farming games relevant. Hey folks, this is Bob interrupting your Retronauts podcast for a special announcement. Jeremy and I will be at this year's PAX West event for three separate panels, so if you've never seen us live before, now is your chance. So in chronological order, the first panel will be Saturday, August 31st at 12:30 p.m. in the Sasquatch Theater, and that will be The Cromulent World of Fictional Simpsons Games. That will be a talking Simpsons panel all about all of the fake video games within the world of The Simpsons. Then on Monday, Retronauts will be closing out the show with two back-to-back panels, both in the Raven Theater. The first one will be at 3 o'clock p.m., and that will be Super Metroid vs. Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which is pretty self-explanatory. The next one will be at 4:30 p.m., and it's titled The Dreamcast 20th Anniversary Necromancy Jam. We'll be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Dreamcast on this panel, and it's also the 10th anniversary of the Retronauts PAX panel from 2009.
Again, that is Saturday, August 31st at 12:30 p.m. in the Sasquatch Theater. That is the Talking Simpsons panel. And then on Monday, September 2nd, there'll be two back-to-back panels in the Raven Theater for Retronauts starting at 3 o'clock p.m. And we hope to see you there.
So our next episode was, we recorded this in the Midwest Gaming Classic. It was my first episode without notes, and I wasn't sure I would go. It went great, and in fact, I got more comments from this than most of the other podcasts that I spent hours writing thousands of words worth of notes. So this, the what I learned was, don't try so hard, but I still write too many notes. But
so that's the ultimate lesson of the podcast about podcasting. Yes, don't try so hard.
Yes, I'm trying way too hard. But so our first comment is from Curtis Bostick, who said, Bob casually slamming the Rock Band mic as a piece of podcasting equipment really got a good laugh out of me, because once upon a time I recorded a Let's Play using one that I never released, Good Times, and I selected that comment not because it praised me, but because I made fun of the Rock Band mic in that podcast because I used it for projects when I couldn't afford an actual microphone or anything else. So we all start there at some point in our lives.
Everyone starts somewhere.
Everyone's got a Rock Band mic floating around somewhere in your house, so you can be a podcaster too. But people won't want to listen to that. But yes, Jeremy, we have Resident Evil 4 up next. You were on that one.
I was.
We have one comment from that.
And it probably is more insightful than anything I had to add for the episode. Bill Nielsen says, great stuff here. Resident Evil 4 remains one of my all-time favorite games, and this episode really gets into the weeds as to why. The RE2 remake is probably the closest any game has come to recapturing that feeling for me, especially in the extra missions that have some of the same action puzzle feel. The main story is great, but only in the extras is there enough open space to try out some more advanced tactics.
Yeah, the RE2 remake is a good model for a modern day remake, I think. I hope Square looks at that, but I don't think they are. That it keeps enough of the original spirit while saying, well, this is a game for modern players. Let's liven things up and let's make things more accessible to what people expect now for a game. But I'm totally with you. I will get around to it. I am a huge chicken, so I might need to turn all the lights on and listen to a podcast while I play, but it looks like a good game. Our next one, we're coming up to the end of our podcast here, but our next one is Aladdin game. So we talked about all of the Aladdin games that came out. So number one, every comment on this was telling me in my notes, I wrote down the developer Dave Perry's name as Doug Perry once. And because of that, I kept saying Doug Perry throughout the show. I know his name is Dave. But in the games press, there was a guy named Doug Perry.
Yeah, Doug Perry was an IGN journalist. He's currently in PR.
For a decade.
For a long time.
Yeah, so it's just like there are two Perrys, and their names are both four letters and begin with Ds, so that's my fault, but I know his name is Dave. And I found out after the fact that Master System was not a port. It is an original game that does not seem too terrible. So those are my mistakes. And I will say there was some blowback on this because we decided that the SNES version was better, and I think people have come around on that, but it's not because I don't like Genesis games. It's because I don't like shiny games. That's where I'm coming from. I don't know, Jeremy, do you have a stance on this? Because I feel like throughout the podcast, I was positing like shiny, before they made 3D games, they made one kind of platformer. So that was Earthworm Jim, Aladdin, and then like there were things made in that style like the Jungle Book. And before that, they made things like Cool Spot. But it's all the same. The characters feel the same. The level design feels the same. And they're just like one interpretation of platformer, just with different graphics.
Yeah, I mean, Shiny made games that were beautiful, just absolutely gorgeously animated, full of detail, and not actually very fun.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Earthworm Jim has some hilarious sight gags, like, you know, launching cows with a refrigerator into space and using Jim, who is a worm, like as a whip to attack enemies because he's like wearing this power suit that basically uses his body as an attack. But, you know, once you get past that stuff, it's just kind of like, I didn't really play Shiny's Aladdin game. So
you
I played
Earthworm Jim, though?
I did play Earthworm Jim.
Yeah, that's the same game, kind of. I mean, the same. It feels the same.
And I played some of their, you know, their PlayStation stuff, like Wild 9 and MDK, and neither of those grabbed me. They just felt kind of like, what am I doing? Why am I playing this? I'd rather be playing something else.
I am thinking about doing an Earthworm Jim podcast. Let me know if you guys want to hear that. I have concerns, though. I don't want to elevate the creator in any way. He's already getting too much money to get a book published, and he sucks. Look it up on your own. I won't tell you why. I don't want to bring you down here. But yes, I'm thinking about doing an Earthworm Jim podcast. But we have a comment for the Aladdin Games episode, and this is more about shiny games in general. So Billy Norby says, many games had rough edges, but I do admire the sense of style shiny had. I don't like that aimless open platform philosophy either, but something clicked with Earthworm Jim. That game really had his fun sense of punk anarchy and humor for its day. In the same rebellious spirit of gross-eyed cartoons like Ren and Stimpy, the snot bungee rope and the hamster were spectacular set pieces, and you kept on through grueling difficulty just to see the next wacky event, even if it meant pulling your hair out. I also think MDK is a very fascinating game, probably some of the most interesting art direction in any sci-fi game has ever had to this day. Kurt Hectic in black leather and his pterodactyl helmet was something like out of Dune, filtered through German expressionism and a French heavy metal comic. The combination of a sniper rifle and wingsuit made for really compelling gameplay, too. I wish some studio would revisit that property again someday. Yeah, I mean, I respect...
There was a sequel.
It was made by BioWare. That's so weird. Yeah, I don't get that at all, but... I see where you're coming from. I do like certain aspects of shiny games, except playing them. They're very hard to go back to. But Jeremy, we have one more on Aladdin games.
Guts Sant says, I wholeheartedly agree with the premise and opinions of this podcast. Unfortunately, in gaming, as in most other entertainment industries, it's quite common that form overtakes substance in the minds of the public opinion. I'd say that Final Fantasy VII is not that good in comparison with VI, V, or IV, but the form encompassed by the next-gen visuals and audio was far better, and this has, in a sense, condemned Final Fantasy to prioritize form over substance in many instances going forward. We also saw something similar in reverse with the Wind Waker. With the Aladdin games, one wouldn't know unless one actually experiences playing both Aladdin games from beginning to end. Besides Japanese humility, I'd imagine that's the reason why Shinji Mikami commented that he prefers the Sega Genesis version. I highly doubt it that he ever actually played it. In fact, I believe he specifically praised the visual presentation, not the gameplay. But I do remember that Perry said the opposite, that if he didn't create the Genesis version, he would have bought the Super NES version.
There's too much humility in game developers.
Gosh darn it.
Yes.
Just be cocky assholes.
But
Make us your bitch.
I saw a lot of comments on this, and outside of the people that said I just am biased against Sega, I do think we are, as a society, we're moving towards the idea that the SNES version is more playable because, I mean, Shinji Mikami made it. It's a good game. So our next podcast is Ninja Turtles in 1989. So I did an entire podcast. It's number 230. It's about Ninja Turtles in the year 1989 because, Jeremy, I wanted you on because I wanted to know where you were. So Henry and myself and Ray Barnholt were all like the audience for this. And my grand theory for Ninja Turtles was... 1989 was the biggest year for them. The movie was 1990, but this was the year that the cartoon finally was an everyday cartoon, not like two 13-episode series. And the toys were coming out, and two games had come out. Because I will say 1989 was Ninja Turtles, and 1990 was Simpsons. And Ninja Turtles kind of shared with Simpsons, but Simpsons dominated in 90. So 89 was like peak Ninja Turtle mania. That was my theory on that podcast. I want to know where you were in 1989, much older than Henry and me.
I was in Lubbock, Texas.
And were you like, was like that considered for younger kids, like Ninja Turtles, or were you like, that's cool?
Yeah, so for me and my friends, Ninja Turtles was this kind of, I don't know, we were in this sort of weird liminal in-between space. None of us watched the cartoon because that was way too childish for us. None of us collect the toys. Some of us would read the comics, like the Eastman and Laird comics, because those were pretty hard-edged and cool. I think we all went to see the movie, and we played the video game. So it was this kind of like weird in-between space. There was a pretty clear demarcation between like things that were acceptable for, what was it, like 13, 14-year-old kids and things that were not. And basically, the you know things that were kind of built around the toy empire, the cartoon, like those were just a little too childish for us. But the other stuff, you know, like the crazy animatronics with Corey Feldman, And the NES game, like those were great.
But you did play the games then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I recently, I guess it's been a few months now, streamed the NES version and my muscle memory came back.
I think that's what gave me the idea to do that is like, oh, that's 30 years old and yeah. 1989 is 30 years ago and all everything Ninja yep. Turtle related came out around that time.
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend who picked up the NES game and I borrowed it from him. And in the course of like, I don't know, a week, I actually managed to finish it. And that is a high degree of self-hatred and self-abuse yeah. that I just don't have the patience for now. But
did you get 99 scrolls per character?
I sure did. And I blasted the shit out of all the robots in the final corridor and made it through to Shredder and blasted him with scrolls. It was great.
So we have one comment from Darth Ender X. It's a bit of a longer one. And so he says, I also found the first TMNT games to be pretty much impossible until probably decades later when I learned a simple strategy that had never occurred to me, and that's making use of the fact that you can switch between turtles at any time. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I would just play through a level until the turtle I was using died. Then I'd have to go back to the checkpoint, though I did at least figure out that I should play another turtle up until a boss, then switch to Donatello for the boss fight. When the better way to play it is to play until your turtle is almost dead, then switch to another turtle and keep going. Because pizza to refill your health is way more common than a one-up to revive a dead turtle. Like the way most people would do the bomb disarming in the dam, you'd have to have almost flawless play in order to make it to the end within the time limit and without dying. But then I learned that the much better strategy is to basically go as fast as you can, eat the damage where you need to, then switch turtles before you die and have to start the whole sequence over. So, wow, I can't imagine not knowing you could switch.
Yeah, that's just – holy crap. Well, it sounded like he knew you could switch. It just didn't occur to him to use that strategically.
Yeah, yeah, that it was like something you would implement to the game to be like, oh, I should use Donatello here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that does make a world of difference for sure.
So our final podcast topic is Nest. And this is one that I definitely was inspired by Jeremy's work on Virtual Boy Works, the YouTube series. You reminded me that there is a Nestor game, and we looked into the character of Nestor. You did a lot of Nestor research. We talked a lot about Nestor with Bill Mudrin, where the character came from, the Japanese artist behind the original comic, who eventually took over. There were two artists after that. One was like man in his 70s who worked on like Roy Rogers comics in the 50s.
Wow.
It's a crazy story, but I want to know before we answer these questions, what was your Nestor? What did you dig up in your Nestor research on the character?
I didn't dig up any of that stuff. I didn't go that deep into it. I was mostly just, you know, like, was Nestor in any other video games? And, you know, there were a few references to Nestor in some localized versions of like, what was it, To the Earth or something?
To the Earth, like there's
like General Nestor, the commander of the Galactic Fleet or something.
There's a football game where he makes an appearance, and Howard and Nestor, or maybe just Nestor, is in the localization of Dragon Warrior. There's a character Nestor that people are trying to find, and yes. It's got to be a reference to Nestor for Nintendo Power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But his shining moment was definitely Nestor's Funky Bowling, which is kind of sad because it's not really that much of a shining moment. It is a kind of janky and weirdly animated bowling game. It has that sort of weird, super smooth CG style with the animation of the characters. Like it looks like he and his twin sister, who appears here for the first time, Hester.
We noted that.
Yes. She shares a similar animation style. They're very like CG rotoscoping. I don't know exactly what, but then it cuts to scenes like close-up portraits of the characters responding to things, and they're very awkwardly drawn.
They're unpleasant.
Yeah, and horrible things happen to them, like they suddenly lose all their hair.
Their teeth fall out.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah,
it's such a weird game.
It's weird, and it came like 2 years after the comic was retired.
Yes, and it was the next to last Virtual Boy release in any territory in the world. By that point, the Virtual Boy was dead.
Mm.
They had stopped making games for it in Japan altogether. And it's just such a strange choice. Like, why did that happen? And the weird thing is, it's not even the best bowling game on Virtual Boy.
Is there one more or two more? There's another Virtual Boy bowling
game called Virtual Bowling, which was published only in Japan by Athena and is a really, really good bowling game. And unfortunately, it's also extraordinarily rare. It's the final Japanese release, and it sells for like $2,000 now.
Wow. So yeah, I was going to use the music from Nestor's Funky Bowling because
good thing you didn't.
That's his one game, but I was like, there's no way I'm making people listen to this.
No, so
instead, I used music from Pilot Wing 64 in that episode, which is nice and soothing.
Right. And he appears as a character named Lark.
Lark, because they're all named after birds.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, we all know it was Nestor.
It's another weird choice. I guess it's like, well, I don't feel like designing a character. This one exists, so I'll go for it. Or someone was a fan of Nestor. But we have a comment from Nestor the Lark himself, uh-huh. Jeremy, if you could take that one.
I was actually a big fan of Nestor back then. Well, clearly. I even eventually borrowed his name for my regular internet handle, which I've been using for more than a decade now. A couple of notes not mentioned in the podcast. The original strips were written by Nintendo Power editor, later managing editor, Scott Pelland. He was a friend – oh, he was with the magazine from 1988 to 2008. That's a long time to work
that's
on Nintendo Power.
That's almost the entire run?
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Nestor was given a friend named Stu, who appeared in just a few strips right after Howard left. I think he was supposed to be the new straight man, but there wasn't anything remarkable about him, and he was quickly dropped and forgotten.
Yeah, we didn't actually read too far into the non-Howard strips because they're just kind of not very good-looking.
They're really bad.
Yeah, they're ugly, and Nestor has no foil. He's just like kind of like a Bart Simpson-style character almost, like a bad boy.
He's basically just like, he's basically an unchecked asshole. The whole thing that worked with Howard and Nestor. And so people really took exception to me saying this in my video. I got some like grouchy comments about this, but there's a sort of Goofus and Gallant element to them where Nestor is like Goofus and doing stupid things and like screwing up in his video games. And Howard is like coming in and kind of nobly saying, actually, what you should do is this. And he's very good natured about it. You know, he's not like negging on Nestor or anything. He's just like correcting Nestor in a good, amiable way. And Nestor is very
I'm
set in my ways.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this thing and then waste his time or fails or something. And I don't know why people really took exception to me making that comparison, but that's absolutely the idea. It's like good cop, bad cop. Like here's the example of the screw up. You don't want to play a video game like this. Play it like Howard says.
And I reread all the comics. They're all online. They're easy to find. But it's like Nestor represents like what kind of brute force solution would a kid try? And here is the counter to that. Here's the actual solution to the problem that you might not have thought of. And it was very well done, and the original art was very good. We talked about the original artist there. So go back to that podcast and check it out. But we have one final comment from Toad64, who says, I remember at least one other comic where they showed what Nestor had been up to. For issue 100 of Nintendo Power, there was, I think, a one-page Nestor's Adventures that showed him now in college. He'd been out of the loop for a while and was introduced to the N64 and its Rumble Pack by his roommate. A quick search on Google tells me this one has been largely forgotten, and I guess we forgot it too. So I thought the only look to the future was Bill's very good comic that he had very little time to make. But I guess there was another one looking into Nestor's future. But I'm glad that there was a closing the book on Nestor. You saw Nestor and his child, and I guess they were going to try to work Howard in, but they didn't have time to find out if they had permission to do it. So Howard might have been in Bill's final strip, but there was just like – he had like a weekend to do it, I think he told us.
I think it worked out well the way it was. I think adding Howard to that would have been just, you know, too many things.
There's like a bow tie like in the room somewhere, like a framed bow tie. So like part of him is there. He's the bow tie guy. So
It's like Sean Connery's portrait in the fourth Indiana Jones movie. It's like, oh, he's dead, but we still love him.
Yes. He'll get like a character payment, I guess, for this movie. But that is our listener comments catch-up episode, the second one I've done of these with that title. But I'll be back in another 6 months to read some of your comments on this podcast. But as for us, if you want to support the show and get every episode of this podcast 1 week at a time, ad-free and at a higher bitrate, please go to patreon.com/retronauts. And for $3 a month, you can get just that. And you can help support the show. You can help us continue renting out this very nice studio space in San Francisco. You can help Jeremy fly down. Help us make appearances at places like PAX, where we will be very, very soon after you hear this podcast. So yes, please go to patreon.com/retronauts to help the show. Jeremy, how about you? You got stuff going on?
Oh, yeah. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. And Bob mentioned my video series earlier. Virtual Boy Works is over. I actually managed to complete the entire Virtual Boy library, which admittedly is not that difficult because it's only 22 games, but still, it's nice to have that put to bed. But now I'm back over to NES Works, chronicling the library of the NES in America, and also Game Boy Works and Game Boy Works Color, where I'm traveling back and forth in time across a space of 8 years to look at monochrome and color Game Boy games released in all regions. And if you like learning about the history of old video games in the chronological order in which they appeared to get some context, that is a thing to watch. And all of these video series will eventually appear as books. There will be a couple of books next year, Super NES, Virtual Boy, maybe NES. I don't know. A lot of books. So many books. So look forward to those.
Cool. And as for me, I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. I have other podcasts you might have heard, and those are Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. I talk about old cartoons that you probably love, so check them out wherever you find podcasts. I have a Patreon, too. That is patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. If you go there and support those shows, you'll get a ton of bonus podcasts, including exclusive miniseries. We just did one about the entire first season of King of the Hill, and there's a new one coming this fall that will be exclusive to patrons. So again, that is patreon.com/talkingsimpsons to find out about my other podcasts, how to support those. But as for us, we will see you again soon for another new episode of Retronauts. Thank you.